Well, I didn't want to miss this amazing opportunity. I wanted to get some pictures so she can remember this forever.
The First Lady makes her first stop in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, despite concerns, lawmakers pass Senate Bill 54.
For the C&B felonies, having them have the same sentencing range, I'm telling you, that is a problem.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the lead federal agency, is hosting a series of public scoping meetings on the proposed Ambler Road now through Tuesday, December 12th, in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and several communities near the Ambler Mining District. The BLM is developing an environmental impact statement and seeking public input. Learn more at blm.gov/AmblerRoadEIS. This message is sponsored by BLM.
The Senate adjourned from the special session today without taking action on a proposal by Governor Bill Walker to tax income from employment to help close the gap between state spending and revenue. Senators did act on the other item on the special session call, the wide-ranging bill to scale back last year's reductions to criminal sentences is headed to Walker's desk. The Senate voted today to agree to the changes the House made to Senate Bill 54. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The Senate passed the bill 11-8, despite a series of concerns raised about the measure. Representatives of the court system, prosecutors, public defenders, and law enforcement questioned whether changes made by the House would withstand court challenges. Several experts say one provision may violate offenders' constitutional rights. John Skidmore leads the Department of Law's Criminal Division. He questioned the provision, which applies the same sentences to people who commit Class C felonies for the first time as those who commit more serious Class B felonies. He says it would certainly face a legal challenge.
For the C and B felonies, having them have the same sentencing range, I'm telling you, that is a problem. That's not just somebody saying, I'm going to file a lawsuit and it may or may not be frivolous. I'm telling you, there is also a legal issue there that the courts will have to resolve.
The Senate passed a version of the bill for the first time in April. The House made 28 amendments in committee and on the floor during the special session. It was those amendments that troubled legal experts on Friday. Senators could have rejected the House amendments, which would have led to a conference committee to settle their differences. But the Senate decided against the move. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says residents have called for stricter penalties. She says the law allows judges' discretion to decide sentences individually.
From a public perception, at least if you have been aggrieved, if you have had someone die close to you, if you have had someone's car, your car taken, that when it goes through a court process, the B or the C does not determine in the end the final consequence. It's the judge.
Bethel Majority Caucus Democrat Lyman Hoffman opposed the House version.
If we see something that is wrong in the bill that's constitutionally challenging, we should not go forward, in my opinion, to make that law and then have that have it fixed later. If we see that it is wrong, we as legislatures should fess up and fix it.
Quinlan Steiner leads the State Public Defender Agency. He says that the flaw with Class C felony sentencing could lead the courts to throw it out, leading back to Senate Bill 91. That means first-time Class C felons would face suspended sentences instead of immediate jail time.
That's what the litigation is going to be about. It's not speculative. It will be filed. It will be an issue in every single C felony case until it's resolved.
Senators who spoke in favor of today's bill described it as tough on crime and said a vote against it would be a step backward. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
First Lady Melania Trump spent some time in Alaska this morning. She was on her way back from accompanying the president during his Asia trip. The First Lady landed at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes woke up a little earlier than usual to be on hand for the visit and joins me now.
Hi, Lori.
Hi. So, Zach, why did the First Lady decide to make an official visit out of what is usually a quick refuel at J-Bear?
You're right. Lots of dignitaries and government officials stop in Alaska while making their way to Asia. Ms. Trump's happened to be right around Veterans Day, which a lot of people officially recognize today. And J-Bear has been having a month of celebrating military families, so this stop fit nicely with that as well, particularly as President Trump has made expanding the military and resources for service members part of his agenda.
What did the First Lady do during her visit this morning?
Well, for a little more than a half hour, she basically chatted with kids. A few were showing Ms. Trump a 3D printer, and the First Lady told them that this was her first time to Alaska and how exciting that was. She mentioned finding it very beautiful and that the air smelled really clean after her recent trip to China. All of this was in a rec center on base, and then Ms. Trump sort of made her way into a big second room where there were a few hundred people on hand waiting to snap photos. And there was definitely some excitement when she entered. And then the First Lady sat with some kids from a pre-K class playing with musical instruments and Play-Doh. And some of the kids' parents were in the crowd. They only learned Ms. Trump would be appearing here on Thursday and started making plans immediately and even got in line 3 hours before it started today to make sure they had spots. I talked with a group of moms who had come to watch their kids get to meet Ms. Trump. One of them was Stacey Doherty. Her daughter sat right next to Ms. Trump.
Well, I didn't want to miss this amazing opportunity. I wanted to get some pictures so she can remember this forever.
Did you get them?
Yes, we did.
Do you think she'll remember? I mean, how old are these kids?
4 and 5. She might remember. If not, we have pictures and videos to remind her of how special this opportunity was.
That reflects what other moms said, too. Some were a little bit nervous, but really excited that their kids were getting this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
I imagine that some of these families have members who are deployed. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, Stacey Doherty, who we just heard from, her husband's been deployed to Afghanistan for around 2 months, part of the 1,200 Army soldiers from the 4th Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division that's stationed at J-Bear. And those soldiers are set to be there on an advise and assist mission through next summer.
Zach, did the First Lady make any statements or take questions from reporters?
No, this was just a photo op. Ms. Trump did spend a couple of minutes by the crowd, and she might have spoken to people there kind of briefly, but reporters were kept quite a bit of way in a pen and guided around by Secret Service and White House staff. We were close enough to shoot photos and TV footage, but this was definitely not an opportunity for questions.
All right. Thanks for being out at J-Bear this morning.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow is Veterans Day, although it's being officially observed today. And beside the American flag, you're likely to spot another national icon, the stark black symbol for prisoners of war and those missing in action. Designed in the early 70s, the POW MIA flag was part of a national movement by families during the Vietnam War to resolve the fates of missing service members. In many parts of the country, the symbol is ubiquitous, even though recent decades of American conflicts have seen practically no POWs. Zachariah Hughes covers the military and wanted to find out what it symbolizes to a younger generation of veterans for whom prisoners and the missing dead are no longer a part of combat.
It's 26 degrees as members of the Service High School Band shift from foot to foot trying to stay warm. They're bringing up the tail end of a parade for veterans, just ahead of a clown walking on stilts, a reindeer led by a leash, and a cadre of older bikers. Flying behind the motorcycles is the black POW MIA flag, with a white silhouette of a young man trapped behind wire and a menacing guard tower. The text underneath says, "You are not forgotten." And the image is everywhere. Patches, flagpoles, there's even a Dodge Charger with a paint job of the somber emblem taking up the car's entire side. The license plate reads POWMIA. And it belongs to someone from a local American Legion post where Woody Quackenbush is a member.
I mean, during the Vietnam War and stuff, it sent people out on patrol, they didn't know where they were.
Quackenbush has a long gray beard and is standing next to a beige three-wheeled hog. He enlisted in the Army in 1962 when he was 17 years old. He says during and after the Vietnam War, the POW flag was a way to draw attention to soldiers the government didn't work hard enough to recover.
We're still trying to find a lot of people that didn't come back, and they don't really have any records of where they are or what they're to look for. Once in a great while, they find somebody, but it's a shame.
Officially, there are still 1,602 Americans unaccounted for from the Vietnam War. That's a lot, but it pales in comparison to past conflicts, where neither the science nor the will was in place to recover the dead. From World War II alone, there are nearly 73,000 service members still listed as missing. But this is an accounting of warfare that's becoming extinct. In the last three decades, the total number of American service members left unrecovered by the military is six. Roger Sparks recently retired after more than two decades serving as a Marine infantryman and later a pararescue jumper who deployed to some of the most rugged parts of Afghanistan. Now he works as a tattoo artist in a suburb of Anchorage.
The conflicts that we're fighting now, you know, it's not an atmosphere that you're being held captive.
Sparks is a highly decorated vet who did a total of 10 combat tours. He says that for many younger veterans, the POW flag no longer marks a literal absence.
I almost view that as, well, that's their era of symbolism. Whereas now I look at that and I'm like, well, that was for them. You know, like I can really identify with the severity of their experiences, but I don't feel I have ownership of that.
Sparks grew up in Texas, surrounded by Vietnam vets. Those men were draftees who generally did one combat deployment. Today's volunteer military is made up of people more like Sparks. And he sees the country's relationship with its wars as marked less by fervent support or opposition than by general indifference. Part of why Sparks thinks the POW flag resonates today with so many veterans, service members, and families is less for the silhouetted young man behind barbed wire than the words below about not being forgotten.
I think that when you look at the flag, you can say, well, that's patriotism. But when you look at that POW/MIA flag, it's more of combat loss, you know, like the reaping, just horror of what has been paid for this country to go on. And I think that's why people feel so strongly about it.
When Sparks started tattooing guys in Afghanistan, they'd sometimes do sessions right after returning to base from pararescue operations, almost like a ceremony to process what they'd experienced. He says no one's asked for the POW insignia. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Nome residents fear for their dogs after a series of musk ox attacks.
I got a call from my son saying, you hurry, you need to get home. The musk ox are all over our place and they've attacked our dog, Bart.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
Contaminated water has been found at the Fairbanks International Airport, prompting officials to plan tests at private wells in nearby neighborhoods. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports neighborhood wells will begin to be tested on Monday to see if they are also contaminated by perfluorinated compounds, which are commonly found in firefighting foam. The airport well is the third in the Fairbanks North Star borough found with the contaminant. Angie Spear, manager of Airport Division Operations, says the foam probably was used in the early 1990s. Firefighting foam was used at the aircraft rescue and firefighting training sites. Studies have linked the contaminant to numerous cancers, but research on it is limited. Over the last 5 months, multiple sled dogs in Nome were attacked by musk oxen in at least four separate incidents. In October, one of the attacks resulted in the death of a dog, and now people in the community, including the pet owner, are asking what can be done to prevent further loss of life. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports.
Longtime Nome resident Vicki Erickson has become accustomed to dealing with musk oxen near her home in the Icy View neighborhood. Erickson says over the last few years, she has lost four dogs to muskox attacks. During Erickson's latest encounter with muskoxen on October 3rd, which she describes as a traumatic experience, Erickson's family dog for 6 years, Bart, was fatally wounded.
I believe it was a Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock. I was at work and I got a call from my son saying, "Yuhuri, you need to get home. The muskox are all over our place and they've attacked our dog Bart, and I don't think she's going to make it."
Erickson says she then called Nome Police Department and the dispatcher told her that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, or ADFG, would send someone to respond to the incident. Alaska Fish and Game biologist in Nome, Bill Dunker, recalled that the responding ADFG employee did not take action against the offending muskox in this incident.
Of the four instances where we had muskox that attacked dogs, two of those animals were shot and killed in defense of life and property. One of those animals was removed by the department, and the fourth animal we were unable to identify. And that animal did not, or those animals in the area, did not continue to exhibit aggressive behavior. And so no further action was taken in that instance.
Dunker says various means used to deter muskoxen in the past have included inflatable bear decoys, water hoses, rubber bullets. Fish and Game has even experimented with bear urine-scented wicks. Most of those efforts have proved to be unsuccessful. Before her dog, Bart, was attacked for the third and final time, Erickson says she and her husband took several preventative steps, including using different types of barriers.
You know, we were out of pens, and fences didn't hold them out, pens didn't hold them out, and this time Mitch had put a bunch of equipment. It looks terrible down there. He put a Jeep down there. We had Connex vans, the greenhouse, a smoker, an outhouse, four-wheelers, snow machines all around these dogs, just trying to make some type of barrier. And one got in, and that was all she rode.
When asked why these fatal encounters between dogs and muskoxen have been happening more frequently summer after summer in Nome, Dunker said he could not speculate on that. Erickson says she knows people, including herself, who have been threatened and charged by a muskox before. She suggests that further action be taken, like removing all of the muskoxen from within Nome City limits, before a muskox claims human lives as well.
"I'm so upset about the loss of my dog. I really don't care if they're herded out, airlifted out, or otherwise. You know, I don't think they should be allowed to be so well protected within the city limits that they put everybody else at risk."
So far, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has not proposed any further action regarding the regulation of muskoxen interactions with people and property. Erickson says for now, she and her family won't adopt any more dogs in order to prevent more animals from being killed by muskoxen. Reporting in Nome, I'm Davis Havi.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Now through December 15th is the open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska. Plan costs have gone down this year. For free help to enroll, visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust. Do you need health insurance for next year? Did you know Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 20% for 2018? More than 90% of Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the costs. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th of this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2018. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, crisis. On a mid-October morning in Ketchikan, it was cold, wet, and windy. A perfect day for a disaster. KRBD's Layla Carey observed a recent disaster preparedness drill from inside Ketchikan Hospital's emergency room.
Every 3 years, always on a rainy day it seems, Ketchikan practices for a plane crash. The drill involves pretty much every emergency response agency and a whole lot of volunteers. Misha Chernik is spokeswoman for Peace Health Ketchikan Medical Center. She says despite the weather, nearly 40 volunteers showed up at about 7 a.m. to become victims. Chernick says they were made up to simulate a wide range of injuries.
That helps with the people who are on the ground who are going to be assessing, you know, what their state is and what where they need to go as far as staging areas and levels of severity of injury.
Emergency room charge nurse Charity Kelly says she spent hours the previous night making fake blood and shin.
With the shin, it is Vaseline, cornstarch, and then cocoa powder to give it the natural skin color.
Kelly says shin stays tacky. You can mold it onto the skin and build up fake wounds.
Like you can impale things or you know, make a deep laceration in it. And then when you do a laceration, you put black in the bottom of it to give it depth, and then you put the red and just kind of build it up.
Kelly gets pretty animated talking about those fake wounds.
Oh, I love it. It's awesome. Love it. Should see Halloween at my house.
After all the volunteer victims were made up and given instructions on how to act, they were taken over to the airport. Somewhat ironically, a big part of the challenge for responding to a disaster at Ketchikan's airport is transportation. The airport is on a different island, so it's a ferry ride away from any real medical care. Perfecting methods to move injured people efficiently to the hospital is critical. Everyone in the emergency room is on high alert, waiting for victims to arrive. In the front reception area, though, there's a quieter response.
As a drill plane crash, are you able to come in?
Chernick explains that reception area employees are contacting colleagues to call them in to work.
Each department calls a call tree of all of their employees to say a disaster has occurred, you're being activated to come in and work. And so then they drop everything and come to work.
Tom, where's my runners?
Back outside the emergency room, the first wave of victims has arrived. Two young men are taken from an ambulance into the first of two bright yellow tents. Chernick says that's the start of the response.
The first tent is where they begin the assessment process and determining how much evaluation they immediately need and whether, you know, they start...
Their
severity of the injuries, exactly.
It's color-coded. Red patients need immediate care. Green and yellow patients can wait a bit. Robert Cope Powell is wheeled through the doors of the emergency room. He's one of the Code Red victims, and he's pretty cheerful about it, joking with fellow Code Redder Rain Hudson lying on a stretcher behind him. I ask Cope Powell if he'll show me his injuries.
Door handle to the chest.
Cope Powell says he was in the bathroom during the crash, and that's when he was impaled. Hudson's face is chalky white to simulate blood loss. He also was impaled, but with a spoon.
I was eating pudding in first class, and then it kind of just, like, kind of happened, I guess. Yeah. And then I got a broken hip, too.
The two teenagers clearly were having fun, and there's plenty of joking among the responders, too. But they're all taking the drill seriously. Bev Crum is the incident commander at the hospital. She was coordinating everyone's response and making sure all the materials are where they need to be. She paused for a moment to talk.
This helps us plan together to utilize the resources that we have in our community to be prepared and for disaster events.
That includes plans for staffing, proper equipment, and updated communication methods. The small hospital also needs options for housing less critical patients. For this drill, Crum says they added the Pioneers Home just down the street as a backup location.
It's practicing because the more you practice, the better it is in real life.
Crum says every time Ketchikan has one of these drills, different issues come up, and they figure out how to improve their response so if or when real disaster strikes, they'll be ready. For AK, I'm Layla Carey.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Niall Morris in Anchorage. Morris is a UAA student and is involved in Black Student Union, Planned Parenthood, and the Title IX Board.
I was a residential advisor at an assisted living facility for people with mental illnesses, living with mental illnesses rather, and I was searching for tools that would empower both myself and the residents. And I had read somewhere that yoga was really good, and I had just attended my first year at university, and I was really enthralled with Carl Sagan's works, and he had said something really great. You want to approach every single aspect of your life with a scientific mind. And I thought, well, I don't have any experience with yoga. Maybe I should do some research. I ended up going to this wonderful place called Spirit Path Yoga and Wellness. Through them, I really learned a lot about both myself and the nature of yoga. It was 200 hours of intensive studies and intensive practice, and when we graduated, I felt really empowered. I went right into teaching, and just a few months ago, I actually went and applied for my ERYT, which is experienced yoga teacher. You have to have 1,000 hours of teaching under your belt to apply for it, and I did. My favorite part about teaching is seeing people, or hearing people rather, and seeing them tell me that yoga has changed their lives in the same ways that it's changed mine. Proprioception and neuromuscular reeducation are two of my favorite concepts in yoga. Proprioception is the body's capability to locate its limbs in space. It has spindles, well, proprioceptors in the joints that tell the rest of the body where these certain limbs are. And a lot of people don't think about it. Like the next time when you're alone, try closing your eyes and doing something that isn't based upon muscle memory, right? And it's a great practice to get into because you then realize that there's so many different things going on with the body that we're just not aware of, and the more awareness we bring, the more refined those movements become. And to perform every act artfully is yoga.
Niall Morris lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Layla Carey and Samantha Davenport. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Davis Hovey in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Utqiagvik, November 15th through the 17th, at the Inupiat Heritage Center from 9 to 5 to discuss proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.